Welcome, everyone. Episode 445 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we have an NBA champion. This COVID-ridden disaster of a season is over. Congratulations to the Milwaukee Bucks, who emerged victorious over the Phoenix Suns in Game 6. They are champions. Drew Holiday, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Chris Middleton, go down the list. All of them get a ring, which is great to see. There's a lot of love in the air today. So we're going to go into what happened in Game 6, some lessons that the Suns in particular could take moving forward, and then we're going to hit our final two by Felicias of the year and talk the biggest offseason decisions for the Suns and the Bucks. Before we get into all that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We are being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is someone who I hope got some sleep last night, even though he was up until an ungodly hour watching that game. Morten Jensen, how's it going?
It is going well, and I did, thankfully.
Well, we brought in a ringer today to help us discuss the Suns, one of the best Suns experts out there. He's an NBA editor and Suns reporter for FanSided. Gerald Bourguet, how's it going, my man?
I'm doing good. How about you guys?
Doing well. Thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you. Can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and any work you'd like to plug?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me on Twitter at Gerald Bourguet, GeraldBourguet. It's a tricky one. And you can find my work on fansided.com/NBA. And I also host a podcast, Valley of the Suns podcast, if you're interested in Suns specific content. So that is all my different avenues of production right now.
And you got your account back.
Yes, my Twitter account is back. No more ZWEO.
Well, we're happy to have you. And let's just dive right in, Gerald. I mean, the Suns go up 2-0. And Mort and I, when we recorded after game 2, we said, you know, it felt like this series was over. We said that we don't think the Bucks are going to win 4 out of the next 5. And to our credit, we were right, because they won 4 out of the next 4 instead. You know, just an unbelievable performance from Giannis Antetokounmpo in particular. 50 points, 14 rebounds, 5 blocks in the closeout game. It's hard to fathom that production just in general, but especially given what we saw 2 weeks ago when we thought his knee imploded and we wouldn't see him play basketball for 12 months. Just an unreal performance from him. Gerald, what were some of your big takeaways from this series in general?
I mean, honestly, it was one of those things where, you know, you look at the Suns going up 2-0 and you see them lose 4 games and you think that they choked it away, but the Bucks were just a better team for the better part of this series. They played phenomenal basketball. And you can't say enough about what Giannis did. Obviously, I think the Suns not having Dario Saric or not having a little bit more size on their depth chart with the roster hurt them in this series. And Giannis was a bad matchup for them in the regular season too. But, you know, you just can't say enough about the dominance that he displayed in this series. I mean, that was Shaquille O'Neal-esque. He was a problem. And for all those people saying that he doesn't have a bag or isn't a hooper, I mean, 50 points in a closeout NBA Finals game, averaging, you know, whatever, it was like 35 and 12 and 5 or something like that on 60% shooting, like just absurd numbers that he put up. And it was a growing experience for the Suns. I mean, I don't want to take anything away from the season they had either, because they really did feel like a team of destiny, especially when they went up 2-0 in this series. I didn't see them losing 3 games straight, let alone 4. Because they'd only done it once all season, but just a really fun series between two really good teams, and the better team won in the end for me.
Yeah. What are your, you know, what are you left with coming out of this series?
That a European won the NBA Finals? Gerald just touched on it with the dominance. Giannis is, like, he's King Ding-a-ling now. Like, he is the number one guy in the league, I think. He is the guy you need to get past now. Mm-hmm. We have this tendency of always, you know, talking up LeBron, and I get that. I'm not saying LeBron is in any way dead or buried or whatever, But it's Giannis's league now. He is the best player in the NBA, and that's warts and all. And we know that he struggles as a shooter. We know that outside of Game 6, the free-throw line hasn't been too kind to him. So there are still areas of improvement, but look at what he can do. Look at the way that he moves around the court. Look at just how much space he covers in a single stride. Look at the shot blocking, the overall defense, the anticipation, the tenacity, just the intensity level on both ends. He knew in Game 6 that he had to put that team on his back. No one else was really stepping up, hitting a lot of shots. I mean, I even tweeted when he had around 23, 24 points that he's probably going to have to score 50, and necessary 50 even. He did. I mean,
so this is your fault.
it's European ESP, you know. And but he understands the situation, right? Like he kind of surveyed his whole team. Like, does anyone got it? Does anyone have it? Anyone have the hot hand? Because that, like, we can all be honest. Game 6 started out very poorly. That was ugly basketball. Everyone was nervous. And he just kind of took it upon himself. That's what I'm left with. If any 20 years from now, when I think back on this win for the Bucks, this is the Giannis performance. And I stand for Chris Middleton, as do you, Bri. Mm-hmm. But that's not going to be my first thing that I associate the series with. That is Giannis Antetokounmpo dominating in ways that he shouldn't be able to. What a game six. What a series. I have the stats right here. 35.2 points per game, 13.2 rebounds, 5 assists, 1.2 steals, 1.8 blocks, 61.8% from the field, which is ridiculous considering just the amount of shots he takes, just the defense that is so keyed in on him. He is the guy to beat now. So good on Giannis for doing this. And his post-game press conference, post-game interview as well. I mean, that guy wears his heart on his sleeve, and as sports fans, how can you not love that?
Yeah. I was about to ask if he had a higher field goal percentage than free throw percentage, but I realized game six probably, that was his saving grace. Game
six saved
him, yeah. Nice. Way to go, Giannis. Yeah, but I think you guys both nailed it. This is... You don't want to say it's like a legacy-defining performance because Giannis is only 26. He's going to have plenty of other opportunities to continue building on what's already an incredible start to his career. But now it's just validation, right? Like, you have to just consider him differently now that he's an NBA champion. And there was, I forget, who reported this. It might have been multiple people over the years were saying Giannis doesn't want to be the face of the league until he wins a championship. But now that he has done that, I think, Mort, you're right. Like, he's going to seize that mantle from LeBron, at least until, Luka's going to challenge him and some of these other young guys. Cade Cunningham in a couple of years might challenge him. But for now, the league is going to run through Giannis and the Milwaukee Bucks, at least for the next few years. And it's awesome to see, like, Chris Middleton, as you said, who we've stand for years. This guy comes up with clutch shot after clutch shot after clutch shot throughout this series. Drew Holiday, who's been one of the most underrated, you only need one all-star game. How good could he be? Is he even that big of an upgrade over Eric Bledsoe? Yes. Yes, he was. Even when he doesn't have, his offense disappeared again in game six. He finished 4 of 19 from the field. But what he did defensively in this series against Chris Paul and Devin Booker, that was one of the big difference makers. So it's just... It's so cool to see these guys get that validation that, these guys are... It just erases narratives, right? It's like, going into this series, could Giannis be the best player on a championship team? Now we don't ever have to ask that stupid question again. Despite his limitations, yes, very clearly, he is the best player on a championship team. Could Chris Middleton be the number two? Drew Holiday be the number three? Now we know the answer. The answer is yes. So I'm glad to see it from the Bucks' perspective, putting those narratives to rest.
Right. But one thing. That question is going to pivot into something else. Can Frank Kaminsky lead the Suns to the championship?
Not even in his home territory, man. That's rough.
Well, I did want to, on the narrative front, Gerald, because I know you saw this article today as well. It's been making the rounds on Twitter. And I don't want to bash CBS Sports too much for this, because this is just how the game is played. We all know, you know, how the media outrage cycle works. But they ran an article today saying this is just like the latest in Chris Paul's playoff collapses, and it's, you know, adding to this legacy of this guy can't get his team over the top. So what would be your rebuttal to that?
I mean, that's pure poppycock, for lack of a worse term that I could use. Like, I don't understand it. Like, the guy is 36 years old in his 16th season in the NBA. He's missed a grand total of 4 games in the regular season over the last 2 years. All-NBA player, all-star player, leading 2 young teams to the playoffs. Oklahoma City Thunder were the 5 seed. The Suns, second best record in the West. Top 10 defense, top 10 offense. They make a finals appearance in his first year together, and somehow that hurts his legacy. I don't get it. I don't get it at all. I understand that Chris Paul has his playoff shortcomings. I understand that he wasn't, you know, the point guard kind of caliber performances that they needed in this series to win. But I credit that more to Drew Holiday and maybe the fact that he wasn't 100% with the ligaments in his wrists that maybe hadn't healed fully. You know, he denied that, of course, he was going to deny that. But he just didn't look like himself with his handle. And I just don't understand how one bad series against a really good team and arguably the best perimeter defender in the NBA tarnishes his legacy. You know, for me, just getting the Suns to the finals, that closeout performance in Game 6 of the conference finals, like, those are the things we should be remembering about his playoff career, not, you know, the turnovers against the Thunder or the 3-1 collapse with the Clippers or having to miss the last 2 games of the 2018 conference finals because he was hurt. Like, yes, we will remember those things, but, like, a game winner in Game 7 over the San Antonio Spurs, that Game 6 against the Clippers, like, those are the things we should be remembering. Even his Game 1 performance in these very finals just 5 games ago, it's crazy how quickly we forget things and how we diminish guys who come to new teams over and over and over and just completely change their win percentage, their culture, their success level. Just the revamps that he's done in L.A., in Oklahoma City, and now in Phoenix, in New Orleans when he first got drafted there, like, I don't buy it for a second. Devin Booker and Monty Williams were very adamant after the game about putting down those types of ideas. So it really is just kind of clickbait at this point, because if you don't have Chris Paul as an all-timer, you're doing something wrong. Your evaluation process is a little bit flawed.
Yeah.
Can I bring up some numbers, because you're absolutely right. What I'm sitting with is this feeling of, what more do people want him to do? Mm-hmm. He hit 55% of his shots in the finals, including 52.2% of his three-pointers. Like, from a shot-making perspective, you can't put a finger on that. He had 8.2 assists per game for someone who's 36 years old playing that amount of minutes, playing that kind of role. You also can't put a finger on that. Defensively, he was in tune to the point that he could for, again, someone being 36. I just don't see where, you know, this ideology of him not being a closer or whatever has any stance in reality compared to what he did, and considering all the factors around him. Like, Gerald, at the top of the podcast, you pointed out the Bucks were just better. That matters. Like, that matters in the grand scheme of things. You can put the best guy in, and it doesn't matter if the team you're going up against is just flat out better. It boggles my mind why we're still somehow diminishing CP3 here. I don't see any valid argument. Some people might say, well, turnovers. Yeah, no shit. Drew Holiday was on him. Like, context is just what I asked for, and it seems that the narrative around this really has very little of it. So I of course, agree. This has no basis in reality.
And I think people just want to see him break through and win that title so badly that when he doesn't, we feel this need to play the blame game. Like, oh, he didn't come through with a point guard-esque performance. Like, he didn't play his best game when it mattered most. So because we can't handle the fact that maybe these are just two really good teams and one of them had to lose. We always have to blame somebody, and it always redirects to Chris Paul, which is stupid because, again, the guy is 36 years old. The fact that he's doing any of this at this age, at this stage of his career, is insane to me.
So I want to now look ahead before we get into the offseason decisions, and we'll get to Chris Paul momentarily as well. What do you think, from the Suns' perspective, they should take away from this series moving forward? And really this whole playoff run, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously when you look at this Suns playoff run, a lot of people are going to point to the injuries that their opponents had. They don't put a lot of stock in it, and neither do I, because injuries are something that you can't really help. You play who's in front of you. And they pretty much dominated everyone except the Clippers in those first three series. Like, they did what they're supposed to do given who they were playing against. And you need a couple breaks to make the finals anyway. Every team that's ever made the finals has gotten a couple breaks in that way. And also, like, LeBron is 36 now. Anthony Davis, injuries have always been part of the calculus with him. Kawhi Leonard, same deal. I think the Suns learned a lot from this playoff experience because four of their top seven rotation players had never played in a playoff game before this season. So it's kind of unprecedented for a team that inexperienced to make the finals, let alone, you know, be two wins away from breaking through and winning it all. So we kind of knew down here in the Valley that Devin Booker was built for this moment, that he would be great in his first postseason. But just seeing the way that DeAndre Ayton came to life until that final series when he went up against Giannis, who, you know, is now the Greek god of the NBA Finals, like, he was fantastic. Mikal Bridges was great until that last series, save for game two. Cam Johnson showed a lot of poise, and these are four guys that are going to be around for the long haul. So it's unfortunate they couldn't break through in a season where it felt like the stars were aligning, but they learned a lot from this experience. I think they learned that you need a couple breaks, and also what it takes on a possession by possession basis. You know, some of the mistakes, some of the no show performances, or the flawed performances from some of the young players, I think that's something they can build on, because they had literally never been in this spot before. They bounced back all season long. They were a resilient team, and I think they established a winning culture this season. You know, Devin Booker said after the game, the foundation now is championship caliber basketball, and obviously you can't make the finals every year, but that's what the expectation is now, and they know that they have the work ethic to get there and the mindset and the talent to do it. So just really a magical season for the Suns. It didn't have the storybook ending that a lot of people here wanted, but you can definitely build off of this, even as Chris Paul starts to fade a little bit thanks to Father Time.
Yeah, I mean, the thing working in the Suns' favor, I would think, depending on what happens with Chris Paul this offseason in particular, this is going to, you know, send the message to other players that the Suns aren't this laughing stock. You're not signing with the Suns, you know, just because they're offering the most money. The Suns are a legitimate championship contender. If they run this thing back next year, sure, they, as you said, they benefited from injury luck, but there's no reason to, like, Kawhi is going to miss at least some of next season. We don't know what Jamal Murray, you know, he might not make it back much before the playoffs. It might not be his full self. We don't know what's going to happen with Utah. Are they going to keep Mike Conley? So that, like, the runway is open here for Phoenix to get right back into this spot next year. I want to ask especially about the two of the young guys. Ayton, let's start with him, because he was, Mort and I, going into the playoffs, with, you know, that first series, Lakers Suns, we said it's going to come down to Ayton. Like, if we get the inconsistent version that showed up throughout some of the regular season, it's going to be an uphill battle for them. If we get an Ayton who can at least, you know, I don't want to say, like, completely match Anthony Davis, but hold his own against Anthony Davis, and then we continue that theme with the Nuggets as well. If Ayton could hold his own against Nikola Jokic, and he did throughout really those first three series. As you said, this finals was really the first time he struggled consistently. So what do you think Ayton takes away from this series, and how does he build upon this, what he learned in this playoff run?
Yeah, I think he had an incredible, like, he has an incredible film catalog to study from, just going up against Anthony Davis, Nikola Jokic, and Giannis, just three of the league's most dominant bigs, and dominant in very different ways. So he has a lot of tape that he can study from this offseason. I think with Giannis, I mean, it's a tough one because he is so big and strong, but he's also graceful and kind of like slithery when he gets that Euro step going. It's hard to stay in front of a guy like that. And I think Ayton, you know, he consistently dealt with foul trouble in this series, which really hurt the Suns because they didn't have Šarić. Frank Kaminsky is a 7-footer who plays like he's, you know, 6'4". And, like, they didn't have it. The small ball wasn't working for them just because of the size discrepancy there. So he definitely is going to learn a lot from that in this regard. His verticality, which has been great for all of this season, was really put to the test, and he didn't kind of rise to that occasion. And it's funny that we're saying, like, he didn't have a great series because, like, the raw numbers, he averaged, like, 15-12 and shot 53%, which is not terrible. It's not what we saw from him in the first three rounds, especially on the defensive side of the floor, you know, playing up to par with these NBA superstar bigs. But I thought he is going to take a lot from this. I think this was about as good as you could have asked for his first postseason at the age of 22 in his third NBA season, especially because, like you guys were saying, he was the Suns' biggest question mark heading into the playoffs. Like, if they didn't get locked in, consistent DeAndre Ayton, they would have gone home in the first round. And instead, they make this incredible finals run where he is consistently matching some of these superstar big men and proving that he can do it when the stakes matter most. So that was, I mean, if you can take another silver lining out of this whole run, it's that DeAndre Ayton solidified his status as, like, yes, this is the big man that Phoenix wants in town for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. And we'll get – he's another guy who they have a big decision about this offseason. And they have another guy, Mikal Bridges, who they have another big decision this offseason. What did you think of him throughout the playoffs and the finals in particular?
I thought he was good. I think his offense was not quite the breakout performance that we were expecting, because during the regular season, you know, he was really good. I mean, he was more of the third member of that big three than DeAndre Ayton was for most of the season, to be honest, because his growth off the dribble, pulling up for that mid-range, attacking, poor closeouts, and shooting nearly 43% from three on top of just his multi-positional defense, like, he was an incredible two-way player for the Suns this year. And you felt going into the playoffs with teams having to hone in on Chris Paul, having to focus on Devin Booker, that the opening would be there for Bridges to have, you know, some breakout series. And I think he had some really good games, like game two of the finals. He was fantastic in that game. But it just wasn't as consistent as you were probably hoping for. With that being said, I think you don't even hesitate when it comes to giving him an extension as well this summer. He's going to be one of the great two-way players in this game, especially, you know, people compare, and he said he studied film of guys like Kevin Durant and Brandon Roy, these other lanky guys that can put it on the floor and get to that mid-range spot. I think if he learns how to attack the rim a little bit more, maybe get to the free throw line a bit more often, he's going to make Phoenix a very dangerous team for the foreseeable future as he continues to grow.
Oh, you're singing my song there, because the free throw thing is one of the things that I've been talking about for a long time. I think with the length that he has and the ability, the newfound ability to put the ball on the floor, you know, he not entirely dissimilar to Giannis, he has these very long strides. He covers a lot of ground. And I think he seems like he's got a quick enough first step that if he gains that separation, he can get to the basket at a much higher rate, which would, I assume, lead to more free throws as well. So if he gets to that level where, like, right now it's even below two shot attempts per game at the line, but if he gets up to just four, then he becomes, that adds a whole nother layer to his offensive skill set. So completely with you there. I think he's been phenomenal overall. I mean, yeah, we didn't see, like, some huge offensive explosion in the finals, but that's also not who he is, it feels like. Like, yeah, sure, once in a while he'll throw in a 25-pointer here and there, but he's not someone who consistently gives you that. Like you said, he's the third guy. He's someone who falls behind that pack of Booker, CPs, on occasion also Aiden, and he just feasts off of that. Absolutely extension worthy. No case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That, this whole segment pained me to the bottom of my heart, let the record reflect. But
oh, I know. I know. I can only really, imagine, Brian.
You've never mentioned that before.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I'm happy to see Mikhail do well and thrive. And no, he was, I think you guys are totally right. It's, you know, they've got to figure out ways to get him more involved offensively moving forward. And part of that is on him. And part of that's on, you know, just figuring out ways to divvy up touches. But I think in game six in particular, it felt like he was trying to force the action a little more in transition. Like once he saw how they got off to such a slow start offensively, he seemed more aggressive. Just like, you know, I know campaign scored quick. I think it was like 10 quick points off the bench. But, you know, Mikhail was like, we just need someone to score, so I'll take it upon me. But then there's that one transition dunk. Giannis blocked one, and then he dunked one off the back of the rim that bounced off. So it didn't quite happen for him, but he's not far away. And, like, these guys are all so young. I think that's the cool thing for the Suns in particular. Other than Chris and Jay Crowder, all of their main rotation players are in their early to mid-20s. So you can reasonably project, you know, they're not finished products. They're going to continue improving and adding things to their skill set moving forward. So it is reasonable to expect, even if the Suns just run this exact same roster back, which I don't think they will, they could be better next year, because maybe DeAndre Ayton comes and has a more reliable mid-range floater. Maybe Mikhail can attack off the dribble more than he did this year. Maybe Cam Johnson has some more offensive versatility. Like there's a lot of room for internal improvement, which I feel like is pretty rare for a NBA Finals team.
It's incredibly rare, and that's why it's so important. I feel like that's a weird word, but it's beneficial that they made this Finals run in a lot of these guys' first playoff run, because Devin Booker's only 24, Mikal Bridges 24, Ayton 22, old man Cam Johnson is only 25. So like they still have a lot of room for growth together, and that's the cool thing about this team, and that's part of the reason why we'll talk about this, but that's part of the reason why I would not be opposed to the Suns just running it back and letting Chris Paul's influence and you know, help facilitate that growth that they showed this season.
Yeah, so let's get into their offseason decisions now, and that starts with Chris Paul. He has a $44.2 million player option that at the start of the year, had you told me he'd be seriously considering turning this thing down, I would have told you you're absolutely crazy. But given how he played this year, given what, you know, bringing them to the finals, Eric Pincus of Bleacher Report reported in June, and I can tell you that he's got another article coming out soon where he's doubling down. He's saying sources around the league expect Chris Paul to turn down that player option. He's looking for somewhere in the three-year, $100 million range. Chris Mannix of Sports Illustrated, when I think this was when Pincus's original report came out, said he was talking to execs around the league. They were pegging his value somewhere around 3 years, $60 million. And if you look at ProfitX has projections for the next 3 years, the 3 years, $60 million, is more in line with what they're projecting. But, you know, the intangibles of Chris Paul are impossible to quantify. And Gerald, as you said, you know, Booker, I know Ayton in particular throughout the playoffs really just kept emphasizing how important Chris Paul was to his development. So how do you see the Chris Paul negotiations unfolding between him and Phoenix this summer?
Yeah, I mean for starters, because I'm already seeing the, you know, LeBron and the Lakers are interested in Chris Paul reports floating around. He's not turning down a $44 million player option to take the mid-level with the Lakers. I'm sorry, he's just not. But I do think he will opt out. I don't think he'll consider other teams unless the Suns are lowballing him and he needs, you know, like the Knicks as leverage, because we've seen the Knicks used as leverage so many times. Poor Knicks. But I got a lot of flack on Twitter this morning for saying this, but like, if I'm the Suns, I'm giving him a three-year, $100 million deal if that's what he wants. I think I start with like a two-year, $60, $65 million type offer, But if he's holding out for three, you give him three. And if the last year sucks and he's hurt and he's old, then you deal with that as it comes. Your whole, the whole point of re-signing Chris Paul is not to rest on your laurels. It's to make sure that you find and start grooming his long-term replacement. Like, because there's no better point guard to learn from, even at this stage in his career, than Chris Paul. So your goal is to find someone. I don't think that player is Campaign. I love Campaign, but I think he's a high-end backup. And I think you just can't let a guy like that walk when he just – you've been in this desert, this playoff drought for 10 years, and it's been absolute garbage these last 10 years. Aside from one season where they won 48 games and just missed the playoffs, it's been awful. And that's all Devin Booker has ever known until the last season or so. So if you let this guy that Devin Booker loves playing with and has spoke glowingly about all season long, if you let him walk out the door and don't have a better replacement, because spoiler alert, there aren't that many options that you can replace Chris Paul with this summer, you're telling your franchise superstar, who now expects to compete for championships every year, that you're an unserious franchise, that you are not... that you're not committed to the same thing he is. And that is when I start to worry, because Booker has put up with a lot of crap through his first 4 or 5 years, and he's taken the brunt of that as, you know, this guy with the reputation of empty calories and, you know, good stats, bad team player. Now he finally shows that he can win, and you don't do everything in your power to keep that going. Like, I just don't get it. I know that Chris Paul's 36. You're going to be paying him through his age, you know, 38, 39 season, and you're going to be paying him a lot of money, and that could be a problem when Cam Johnson's extension comes around. But, like, you need to do what you can. Robert Sarver has to pay up to keep this team together, because they've only been to the finals 3 times in 53 years as a franchise. They've never won a title, which is the longest title drought in the NBA for any organization. Like, you have to do what you can now to capitalize on what's left of Chris Paul's window, to prove to Devin Booker and the rest of this young core that you're serious. And winning helps with the culture. It helps instill good habits. It helps attract more talent for the future. So I just don't understand the Suns fans that are saying, you know, he faded in the finals, or, you know, we saw that, you know, he always gets hurt in the finals. Like, who cares? They went to the NBA finals. They were 2 wins away from winning it all. You know, if they close out the fourth quarter of Game 4, or if they don't have a turnover or that horrible second quarter in Game 5, we're talking about something completely different here. So it really is a game of inches, even in the NBA. And I just think you try to push for a 2-year deal with Chris Paul, but if he pushes for 3 years, 90 mil, 100 mil, you have no leverage in this situation. Like, you're the Phoenix Suns, who were a joke for the better part of the last decade. You do what you can to keep a good thing going.
Yeah, I know. So Pincus's article touches on the Lakers possibility, this one that's coming. And he does note that the MLE option is just not going to happen. You know, they're either going to have, like, at most they have the $9.5 million non-taxpayer MLE, and that's going to hard cap them, or you have the $5.9 million. Like, no, that's out.
How dare Chris Paul not be interested in the mighty Lakers, right? How dare he?
Doesn't he want to win?
Yeah, right. Take a $40 million pay cut. So the other options were they could trade every single player on their roster not named LeBron or AD, and they would only have $21 million in cap space. Or he was suggesting an opt-in and trade, which is how he got from the Clippers to Houston. And that could be, you know, sending some combination of KCP, Kuzma, Talen Horton-Tucker in a sign-and-trade, Schroeder in a sign-and-trade. I forget who the last one. Oh, Alex Caruso in a sign-and-trade. But he also noted, like, all of these are just so unrealistic because the Suns have to say yes. And, you know, are they going to sign off on Chris Paul for Dennis Schroeder and Kyle Kuzma? Probably not.
We should start finding the Lakers when fans begin to get a hold of the trade machine.
Well, Russell Westbrook popped up today. I don't know if you guys saw that. But he did.
I would love that, though, because that would just be fun.
Yeah. Go ahead. So Pickens does mention the Knicks, as Gerald, you brought him up too, because they have $50 million in cap space, and Leon Rose, the Knicks president was Chris Paul's former agent. So there are connections there. But I mean, I go back to what you said, you know, yeah, the Knicks made the playoffs. They're a nice surprising story. If Chris Paul looks at these two teams in a vacuum and he says, which team gives me the better chance of making the finals? Sure, I you know the Western Conference is tougher than the East, but in the East, we still have to go through Milwaukee next year. We're going to have Brooklyn's going to be there. We'll see what happens with Philly. Atlanta's on the rise. Compared to the West, where, as you said, you know, LeBron's getting older. AD, we can't ever be sure that he's going to be healthy in the final, or like once the playoffs roll around. Kawhi's hurt. Jamal Murray's hurt. Like, the Suns might have a better shot just in a vacuum based on the injuries and the landscape than the Knicks, even with without regard to the talent on their respective rosters. Then take into account the Suns have a much better roster than the Knicks. I don't see why Chris Paul has any incentive to leave Phoenix, unless, as you said, Robert Sarver says, 3 years, $45 million, take it or leave it. And the Knicks are like, 3 years, write a blank check, we don't care, $130 million, fine. What's your read on the Chris Paul situation? How do you think that goes down this summer?
I think he stays. Look, he is so competitive. He has been angling for a finals berth for years. Now he got one. He has a team next to him that's only going to get better. He's not attached to a lot of old guys who are going to decline. I mean, he's a smart guy. Surely he recognizes that Devin Booker is going to come back better next year. DeAndre Ayton is going to come back better next year. Same goes for Mikal Bridges, Cam Johnson. If Cameron Payne is retained, him as well. I mean, there's really no reason to look at this Sun squad and say, well, it's a finished product, because it's not. A lot of these guys still have so much more potential left in their tank. So he's a smart guy. He would want to stick around. Of course, like you said, Bri, if Robert Sarver is going to lowball him, that changes the dynamics. So that would be some variable that we need to take account of. But if everything holds true, that Sarver recognizes the situation that he's in, and he goes, you know what, if it's 3 years, $100 million, fine, let's just go do it, then I don't see a single scenario that makes sense outside of him, you know, sticking around here. I would be shocked if he's not a Phoenix Sun by next season.
Same. And Sarver has said, to his credit, that he's willing to pay up to keep, I think it was within the last year, that he's willing to pay up to field a contender, and that's what he has now. So hopefully he's true to his word on that. But just given the way that Chris Paul has spoke about this team, the way he said he wanted this trade to Phoenix to play with Devin Booker and Monty Williams, just the way he spoke, he's called like Mikal Bridges like one of his sons, just the relationship he has with some of these guys. It's like, I don't see him leaving that kind of team. He loves these guys. He loves being around this group. And, you know, that's a cliche to say that kind of thing. Guys always say stuff like that, but it really did feel authentic, especially with a finals run to back it up. So I would also be shocked if he left this summer.
Yeah. And on the Monty note, I mean, I saw that clip going around this morning of Monty going to the Bucks locker room to congratulate them. It's just like, that dude, it has to be one of the nicest, classiest guys in the NBA. And like, that should matter too. I mean, Chris has a longstanding relationship with Monty Williams predating his Phoenix days, but you know, I would want to continue playing for that man. He just clearly respects players as human beings, not just as commodities who help him get a ring. So that could be another thing keeping, you know, not only Chris in Phoenix, but helping lure some other outside talent to Phoenix as well. Let's go into the other big decisions for Phoenix. DeAndre Ayton, we have to start there, and I think it's probably not going to be a super long conversation because he's eligible for an extension this offseason. I think, especially after this playoff run, he's going to expect a 5-year max deal. Gerald, do you sign that check?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it could reach up to 5 years and I think $168 million, which is what guys like, you know, Cat and Joel Embiid have gotten. Ayton's obviously not on that same caliber of player, but, you know, he's earned a max. What he did in his first season at age 22, or his first postseason at age 22, was incredible, and he's only going to get better from here. You know, you mentioned possibly developing a mid-range floater. You know, there's been this idea that he's going to have a three-point shot, and maybe he will in a couple years. It's not there yet, but he's only going to get better at what he does, and he's already really good at what he does. I mean, I would argue that he's a top five center in the NBA, if not just on the cusp of that right now. So I think you pay a max for a guy like that. You don't mess around with that kind of thing. And I think he's earned it. Like, he's proven himself as a cornerstone for this franchise for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the most admirable things about Ayton, beyond just how well he played throughout the playoffs, is that he's clearly embraced this role. And Mort and I have talked about this, where, you know, he's not trying to have the entire offense run through him. Like, he gets it that, you know, it's running through Chris and Devin. He's just got to set good screens, roll to the rim. Like, he's not trying to have 50 post-ups per game. He's not getting frustrated and checking out defensively if he, you know, doesn't go and touch the ball for most of a quarter. So I think, you know, if you're trying to build on that type of team-first culture, DeAndre Ayton seems like the perfect guy to keep in your organization. And he just, I mean, you know, based on just kind of the clips from post-game press conferences that I've seen, he just seems like a genuinely great dude.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right about his mentality, because that's huge for the Suns, because on a team with Booker and Chris Paul, you need a guy that's willing to kind of take that backseat offensively and focus on the things that he's really good at, which is setting strong screens, rolling hard, finishing around the basket at an elite level, and just being the defensive anchor. And he did all of those things during this postseason run. So it's rare for a number one pick to have that kind of mindset, but he does. He just wants to be better and he wants to win. So as long as that continues to remain the same, you know, there's always the disease of more as teams get better. So maybe that it'll get to that point one day, but right now he's just a young kid that wants to win and wants to compete. So he's got that right mentality for that.
Yeah. More.
I will say something that I think we need to take into account, because I agree. I think a couple months ago, well, a little bit longer back, I was a little bit more skeptical about maxing out DeAndre Ayton. I wasn't really sure that was the right approach. That is dead and buried. I think he's a max guy, but I do think you need a plan with him moving forward. Mm-hmm. I think he is too talented offensively to just play this sort of spot role. And I understand what he did this year was for the betterment of the team, and that worked. That's great. But I do still think he needs to receive the opportunity to establish himself more offensively. I mean, we saw him in year two average 18 a game, and yes, he was force-fed a lot. That shouldn't come into play. But I want to make sure that if he's paid, you know, what is that per year, the max? Like 34 million per year?
Mm-hmm.
Something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
I would want to, at some point pretty soon, to see the offensive production go up a little bit. And that's not me putting that on his shoulders. That is me as an NBA organization recognizing that as Chris is going to get older, as Jay Crowder is going to get older, you know, it's necessary that we balance things out offensively and defensively. And he is just such a big guy who's got such a great touch around the basket that it makes sense. I mean, for crying out loud, this guy was compared to David Robinson coming in to the NBA draft. So I think it's just so important that we don't get lost in the whole, oh, he's this role player superstar, mm-hmm. in a way. He is a featured star. He should get those touches. This isn't me going, hey, remember Andre Wiggins who promised he'd get better? That's not the route. I'm not going to sit Ayton down and ask him if he wants to get better, because I think he is getting better. It is looking internally. It's looking in the mirror and going, we need to make sure that we have a plan for this. That is all that I need to be aware of. And then I hand him the max contract, no questions asked.
Yeah. Mikal Bridges is the other big name up for an extension this summer. I definitely don't think he's a no-brainer max guy. I don't think he's going to get the max just based on what we've seen from similar 3-and-D types, OG Anunoby in particular. So, Gerald, what would you be comfortable offering Mikal in an extension this summer. Do you think the Suns can get it done? Or, I mean, you know, if they do re-sign Chris and, you know, sign DeAndre to a max, all of a sudden you've got three guys probably taking up 100 plus million in cap space. You know, do they start to get nervous if you add a big deal for Mikal on the books? And maybe do they wait and let this thing play out in restricted free agency instead?
I think you extend both Ayton and Bridges this summer. I think OG and Anunoby set the market very well for a guy like Mikal Bridges. Like, he got 4 years and 72 mil, I think. I mean, I would probably be comfortable paying Bridges like 4 years and 100 mil, honestly. And that's, maybe I'm higher, but I feel like the development he's going to make on the offensive end, coupled with just how much better he's going to get defensively, and he's already fantastic on that end. He's going to be a very important two-way player. He's kind of the glue that holds them together on both ends a little bit. So, and I think his offensive role will increase just like Ayton's, especially as the Suns try to ease Chris Paul's load if they re-sign him over these next couple seasons. So, I think a four-year, 100 mil deal isn't out of the question. I would probably aim for like 4 and 80, but if you have to go as high as 100 mil to keep a player like that around, then you kind of do it. And that's one of the things Suns fans get so nervous about, these kind of conversations like, oh, we're going to be paying all these guys all this money. Like, you're not going to be paying him anything. This is literally just on Sarver right now.
Right.
Like, you'll have to worry about Cam Johnson and taking care of him down the line, and maybe that gets dicey depending on what you give Chris Paul. But, like, in the here and now, you need to keep core players around, and you will figure the rest of it out as you cross those bridges. Like, for now, take care of the bridges in front of you.
I was wondering if that was a pun. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is why I'm single.
I mean, I will point out that if they sign Ayton and Bridges to extensions, they won't kick in until the 22-23 season. Right. So next year, they're not going to have to worry about the luxury tax either way. It's really at 22-23 seasons, the first time where things could really, you know, push into tax territory and we start to have those conversations. But more, how would you handle Bridges' negotiation this summer? Is 4 years, 80 to 100 seem about right to you?
It does, but I want to have a conversation with Bridges and his team and more or less gauge where they're at. Like, are they just so hell-bent on getting an extension in place, or would they be interested in actually saying, okay, we'll wait it out for a restricted free agency in some capacity, believing they can get a better market, because the more data you have to work with, the better. But of course, if he does reach restricted free agency, there are going to be teams out there that are basically going to look at that as an opportunity and go, hey, look, we can potentially break up a very good finals team right here because we can max him out. And maybe Robert Sarver will say, that's just too rich for my blood. So yeah, if you can lock him for 80, the 100 million is, it's a tough one. Like, I feel that's a little bit too much, but at the same time, I also fully recognize that he plays this vital role, which matters. I also fully recognize that he's only 24. He's going to be 25 next month. So if you lock him up as the extension kicks in, you're getting him in the physical prime of his career as well. So there are certain benefits. I think I'm just a little bit more squeamish after that one year of increased offensive productivity. I'm asking myself, is that a big enough sample size for me to feel comfortable with it moving forward? But ultimately, yeah, I mean, I don't think he can go wrong. Like, the baseline for him is pretty high. The question is, what's his ceiling? That's the big thing. But if he just tops out at what he is, then he's, what, the best two-way perimeter guy on the team?
Yeah. I think that's the... Because you brought up a good point there, because, you know, we were saying, I feel like, very similar things about a guy like Gary Harris just a few years ago. And obviously the injury thing was the biggest factor for him. But that extension, everybody pretty much unanimously praised it at the time, even though it was a pretty hefty extension, because, the trajectory on both ends of the floor was just nowhere but up. So, I mean, Mikal Bridges hasn't missed a game, I don't think, in his first three seasons due to injury. But yeah, I mean, I think you definitely start off with 480 and leave it at that. And if they push for higher, then maybe I'm more willing to go a little bit higher just based on my faith in his offensive growth and what we're going to see on that front. But, you know, I feel like 4 years, 80 is a pretty good place for the market to be set based on what OG got last year. Yeah. and what the market looks like right now.
Agreed. And also, defensive players are just routinely undervalued. I mean, that's something we saw back when John Hollinger was in Memphis. Like, he looked around and realized, okay, look, we can actually get defensive-oriented players for a penny on the dollar. And, like, Oji Anunoby, you could even argue, is underpaid, considering his defensive versatility. He can guard four positions. He's a tremendous three-point shooter. If he hit the open market right now, one team out there, at the very least, would max him. And I have to assume someone would do the same with Mikal Bridges. So if, yeah, I guess I'm painting myself into a corner here, and then basically saying if he is offered $80 million over 4 years, you know what? Go ahead, take it. If it's 100, take it. As long as it's not a max, yeah. I think that's gonna probably serve the Phoenix Suns best in the long run.
Yeah, like Jaylen Brown got 4 years, 115 from Boston, right?
And that was before he broke out.
Yeah, right. And I think that's probably too high for Mikal. But if you end up getting him, like, I agree, 4 years, 100, I'm not thrilled about it, but I still do it because, as you said, like, he plays a position that is just so rare in the NBA, this two-way wing where you can really, you know, elite defensively already, and you can see there's room for growth offensively, but he's a great three-point shooter, if nothing else. Like, that guy's going to stick in the NBA. There is no bust risk with Mikal Bridges at this point. So some team will come with an absurd offer next summer if you don't get him down now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the only other guy that we... The other big guy, with all due respect to Frank Kaminsky, of course. Cameron Payne, out of the league 2 years ago, and then playing an integral role on a finals team this year. They have his early bird rights, I believe, since they signed him last year. So he's been under contract for technically two seasons now, which means it's a similar situation with Reggie Jackson, with the Clippers and Reggie Jackson, where they can offer, it's like $10.1 million as a starting salary. So, you know, a four-year deal is a little bit north of $40 million. Gerald, what do you think is a fair price for bringing back Payne, and how... You know, given all of these other big salaries that we're talking about, how important is it for the Suns to bring him back next year?
I think it's very important, just because, especially with Chris Paul getting up there in age, especially if you're looking at this postseason run and saying, okay, Chris Paul got dinged up a couple of times, we want to save him a little bit more during the regular season than we did this year, which was our first year together. We want these guys out there as often as possible. Now we have the chemistry. Now we have the system. We have familiarity there. We want to kind of dial back Chris Paul's minutes. You need a high-end backup to, you know, help alleviate some of that burden. Campaign, we saw in the finals that he is not the best at, like, running an NBA offense, but he can score. He can score. He gets downhill. He drives. The Bucks did a really good job of baiting him into a lot of drives, and they had the length to, you know, attack some of those layups and swat those away. But throughout the playoffs, he was really good at just coming in, providing energy. He was a very good pull-up three-point shooter and just three-point shooter in general this season. So I think it is important to bring him back. I was saying earlier in the year when he was kind of breaking out, like, 3 years, 27 to 30 mil for him would make sense. And I feel like that's probably true still now. I think he might have lost himself a little bit extra money that he might have made if he had had a really strong finals performance, but, you know, just looking at the whole meat of this playoff run, he was really good and he was really important for their bench unit. So I think, especially as you're trying to ease Chris Paul's minutes and his load a little bit, you need to bring a guy like Campaign back, especially because, you know, the backup point guard market, I don't know how many guys you're going to find that are going to be able to do what Campaign does as immediately for this team, especially.
Yeah. Yeah, I was looking up, like, what are the high-end backup point guards in the league making. I'm thinking like Monte Morris, De'Anthony Melton, all of those guys are right around like $8-9 million a year. Tyus Jones was the same. So I think they will be able, you know, if he's interested, you know, like being able to offer his starting salary of $10.1 million, I think that's like the right range. It's really, you know, what does Cam Payne see for himself? Like, does he think he could be a starter on a good team? Because if they re-sign Chris Paul, he's not going to have that opportunity in Phoenix, at least for the next few years. So, you know, does he look, maybe a Bulls reunion is in order, or, you know, like the Knicks always need a point guard. Does he look at a team that offers him more of an opportunity for playing time, or does he prioritize coming back to, you know, a team that is at least might offer him less money and less minutes, but a better chance at actually winning a ring?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he hasn't had the big payout, right? I mean, he's earned, what, around $12 million, which for us is definitely a big payout. But in NBA context, that's not a whole lot, especially after you hit your mid-20s. So I would be surprised if someone out there like offered him $16 million and he declined that to return to Phoenix for like $8 or $9 million. I think that's probably where he just decides, you know what, I got to take care of myself and I got to take care of my family. Mm-hmm. I got to take care of everything. In which case, I mean, you can never blame someone for doing that, by the way. But if those offers are mostly the same, $8 to $9 million, I see absolutely no reason why he would leave Phoenix.
I'd agree with that. And I think just like we were talking about with Chris Paul, the Monty connection is important there because they have that history with the Thunder, and Monty was in on that call when he kind of got called out of the blue. He wasn't in the NBA, and they called him to pick him up for the bubble squad. And he was thrilled to be able to play for a coach that was familiar with him and actually trusted him to give him minutes in that bubble. And he played great in the bubble, and that was kind of the start of this whole relationship. So I think if the offers are similar, unless some team is offering a lot more money or like a starting job, I would also be surprised if Cam Payne left kind of the only team in the NBA where he's really found traction so far in his career, and the only coach that's given him that same kind of shot.
Yeah,
that's a good point. I mean, he's never played more than 77 games for any franchise. So essentially, he's never played a full season for anyone, which means the loyalty factor right now because of the finals run is probably at the highest with the Suns.
Yeah,
it feels similar to what the Clippers are dealing with Reggie Jackson, where he might have some bigger offers elsewhere. I think, you know, in a vacuum, Reggie Jackson might get paid more than Cam Payne, but again, I don't think like a $18 million a year offer is coming for either one of these guys. But I think both of them have found such comfort in their respective roles on their respective teams that they genuinely might take a little bit less. I mean, Jackson, because he did have one big contract already, I think has even more incentive to stay with the Clippers. But yeah, I don't think that $15-16 million a year offer is coming for Cam Payne. So was he going to take $12 million a year instead of 10, if that's what it comes like? Again, if Phoenix lowballs him and says we're handing out all these other big contracts and we can only sign you to $4 million a year and someone's offering 12, that'll probably do it. But if they can, you know, given that they can go up to 10.1, they have the opportunity to re-sign them if they want, I think.
Right. But one note, though, the point guard market in the NBA is shrinking. So that could affect, you know, the offers out there. Maybe some team basically says, you know, we see the writing on the wall. There aren't really a whole lot of point guards available. And it doesn't project like that position is going to get loaded at least for a couple more years. So maybe we just got to roll the dice and sign someone like Cam Payne to $15-16 million a year. In which case, bye-bye Phoenix.
Yeah. All right, so let's switch to the Bucks now. They do not have nearly as many big decisions to make this offseason as the Phoenix Suns do, but they have a couple minor ones that are important, especially given how the playoffs and especially the finals played out. Bobby Portis is number one on the list for them. You know, was in and out of the rotation really throughout the postseason, didn't play a ton during that Nets series, stepped in for Giannis after he got hurt against the Hawks, and then Big Shot Bobby off the bench was their third highest scorer last, you know, in game six with 16 points on 6 of 10 shooting. They signed him to a 2-year deal that was a second-year player option. So he has a $3.8 million player option, which I'm assuming he will decline. Unlike the Clippers with Reggie Jackson, unlike the Suns with Cameron Payne, they only have his non-Bird rights. So they can only offer him 120% of what he earned last year, which means his starting salary in Milwaukee, if he stays, will be about $4.4 million. Gerald, how much do you think the Bucks need to re-sign Bobby Portis? And do you think they can, you know, I think he probably will be looking at offers, maybe not like, again, 15, 16 million, but it wouldn't surprise me if he gets most, if not all, of mid-level exceptions elsewhere. So, you know, do you think they could keep him around for a couple less million next year?
I don't. I mean, I think that they should try, absolutely, because he was really good. And obviously, you know, going up against the Suns team, having guys with that size was a big advantage. So he played a really big role, and he hit a lot of, you know, corner threes and made a lot of plays that just kind of got under the Suns' skin, like the just blocking Chris Paul from talking to Scott Foster last night. Just little things like that to get under an opponent's skin. They, you can't really measure that kind of impact, but I don't know if they can afford him at this point. He might have played himself out of their price range, just because, you know, he was kind of in and out of their rotation in the playoffs, but he did showcase the kind of skill set that another team would like to have coming off its bench. And especially if you can weaken the team that just won the NBA Finals, you should try to do that as well. So I think you try to get him back if you can. Try to play to, you know, his sensibilities of, hey, we just won a title with you, we love you, we want you back, that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, money talks. So if he gets an offer that's, it's kind of like the campaign thing, if he gets that kind of offer, I think it would be in his best interest to go on and move on and take it.
What about you, Mort? What do you think happens with Big Shot Bobby?
Well, so question, do they have their tax MLE?
Yes.
So they could technically renounce him and then re-sign him with the tax MLE.
Yeah, which would be, yeah, $5.9 million.
That's actually a lot better. I mean, I'm not saying it's what he's worth. I think he's worth more, but compared to 4.4, that's at least a big step up. And I think the tax MLE is 2 years, right?
Yeah, I believe it would have to be at least two.
Yeah, so that's like a 2-year. Oh, well, it doesn't really matter. My point was that you could sign him to that 2-year, then make the second one a team option or a player option, or, well, probably a player option, really. Then he opts out. But then he restarts, right? Then do you still have Bird rights if you renounce him first and foremost? Or do you even need to renounce him to sign him to?
You wouldn't need to renounce him. You could just...
Okay, so the Bird rights carry on. So that means after that second year where he's earned 5.9, then you can actually sign him to 175% of that salary, the 5.9 million.
Or slightly above the average. That was what I was going to suggest. Well, not necessarily the MLE, but like even if they just... Say you go up to Bobby's agent and you say, look, we're limited. We can only give you 4.4 if we want to use the MLE 5.9.
Right.
We'll give you a 1+1 deal, and then next offseason you can opt out again. We'll have your early bird rights. We can pay you 10+ million starting salary. So we will take care of you. It's just going to take an extra year to do so.
Yeah. That's what I would do.
Yeah. And I don't know if that works. I mean, I'm with you, Gerald. Like, you know, he could very well be getting the full MLE elsewhere, and that's 9.5 to start, and maybe he says, okay, cool, this was fun, but I'm going to go get my money, because he played for the Knicks last year on the $14, $15 million contract, but he also hasn't had a big payday outside of that. I do think, I mean, you know, the comments he gave to, I think it was Shams Charania of The Athletic recently, where he said he kind of viewed this as an investment year. He's like, I played for the Knicks, you know, I got my money last year. The culture was awful. I hated it. I wanted to go to a team where I could actually win and prove that I can make an impact on a winning team. And mission very much accomplished there. So, you know, whether a contender comes calling with a significantly bigger offer, I think it'll be tough just because so many of these teams don't have the full, you know, most of them are going to be limited to the taxpayer MLE. So again, it comes down to what are you prioritizing? Chances of defending your championship, bigger role, you know, more money, more minutes, whatever the case may be. I could see a world wherein he takes slightly less money to stay.
Yes.
If they have that promise of, that, you know, one plus one deal, and then next year we'll hook you up for taking the discount this year.
Which is totally legal, by the way, but of course. Right. That's, let's not even take that into consideration, because why would we?
Right.
So I follow Bobby closely, of course, in Chicago. So... And he was the guy that I wanted back in 2015 on draft day as well. I really went into to like study his character and like who he was as a basketball player at Arkansas. If there's a guy out there that could be super unpredictable, just in terms of, you know what, I love it so much here that I'm willing to sign a extremely cheap deal, it's Bobby Portis. Mm-hmm. Like he is a guy who's very, very emotional, who loves to be a part of things. Like the fact that the crowd are screaming Bobby, 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 mm-hmm. the fact that he has this relationship with Giannis, I am telling you right now, those things matter. That those are not things that he takes lightly. He will stand there with a major offer on one hand, and he will have all the love from everyone else on the other hand, and he'll go, what am I going to choose here? That is going to be a legitimately tough call for him, because this type of atmosphere is perfect for him. Like, he's not a starter, regardless of how we slice it. Like, this, the role that he had for Milwaukee this year is the role that he's going to be having everywhere. Like, he's not going to be a 28, 32-minute player whatsoever. This is his role moving forward. It's perfect for him. And if he re-signs with the Bucks, he's also fully aware that could mean future rings. The more rings you get, what does that mean for you after you retire? That means a lot of endorsements. That means the whole of the world opens up as NBA champion Bobby Portis. Mm-hmm. So I think that he has the long game in mind, and I wouldn't be shocked whatsoever if the Bucks told him, you know what, next year, modest contract, but the year after, Bobby, the year after, that's when we get rolling. I think he will trust them. I think he'll say, you know what, that's good for me. Let's roll it back. Let's win one more time. And maybe this, like he called Giannis before last year. Maybe this time, if Giannis calls him, that will make everything in the world good for him. I think he's a guy who we could definitely see sign another cheap contract.
Yeah. We could see Bobby Portis Nissans popping up all over Milwaukee in 10 years. And then... No, it's a fair point, though. And really, I mean, that is their biggest free agent decision, right? They have Giannis locked up, Middleton, Drew. They have Dante DiVincenzo, who can become, he's extension eligible this year, but especially given the injury, I don't know that they're going to extend him a big offer. They'll probably just kind of wait to see what happens there. So they're in pretty good shape for a team that just won the title. You know, they'll have the taxpayer MLE if they don't use it on Bobby, so they'll, you know, probably try to find a backup point guard not named Jeff Teague, but
yeah, I have a name. I have a name.
Okay.
And I am not trying just to hype him up. I think it makes sense. Ife Lundberg, Danish guy. Yeah, but I'm going there. I'm going there because I think he makes sense. He's 26. He aligns with Giannis. He is a tremendous pull-up, three-point shooter. He's got on-ball defense capabilities. And you know what? Regardless of how we slice it, he can't be any worse than Jeff Teague right now.
That is true. That is true. Patty Mills, I feel like, will be the dream MLE, the dream taxpayer MLE target for every contender, and then someone's going to give him a lot more money. But I'm going to throw him out constantly over the next 2 weeks. The other thing that I want to talk about with the Bucks, because like there's a real chance they just run this thing back, right? Especially if you're adding Dante back to the mix. Figure out if you keep Bobby, add Dante, figure out what you do with backup point guard. Like, you have basically your same 8-man rotation in the playoffs, but even slightly better because you have Dante. So Sure, you can make a real argument, just run this thing back, but you could also say, look, if Kevin Durant had a slightly smaller shoe size, they would have gotten knocked out in the second round, and we'd be having a very different conversation about the Milwaukee Bucks this year. So I do wonder if they explore trades, and I'm looking at Brook Lopez in particular.
Oh my God, you will never get off of that, will you?
I'm just saying, if he's only averaging like 20 minutes in the finals, 20, 25 minutes, that's at least something you have to look at. So I want to throw out a couple potential names at you guys and just tell me if I'm totally off base here. Like,
yes, oh. Yes, you're off base.
It's very possible. But like, I just think you can get, if Bobby's coming back, you can steal minutes with him at the five. Giannis is going to play the five at times, especially in the playoffs. Mort, you and I have talked repeatedly about how center depth in particular, you can find cheap centers. You can find cheap, productive centers in free agency.
But you can't find a Brook Lopez. Look, Brook Lopez, as I tweeted last night, is grotesquely underutilized offensively. He might still be one of, outside of Joel Embiid, of course, he might still be the best low post scorer in the NBA. Still. For whatever reason that's not being utilized, that we can agree on, that for what if he's not being utilized, then what the hell is the point?
Right.
But having that option, though, in the playoffs, where you know if things go haywire, there's always that opportunity of, hey, Brooke, go deep. Long pass. There you go. Like, that option is on that table. If you trade him, that option goes away. So I'm going to have to be blown away by this for to agree to any of your trades. So the pressure is on, my friend.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I agree with you that he's being underutilized, and that's kind of my point. Like, if you're just right. using him mostly as a pick-and-pop center, those will be harder to find in free agency, but, like, hey, maybe you get Frank Kaminsky back home on a minimum deal, and, like, you could steal 10 minutes a game with him, much like the Suns did in the finals in Game 6.
The Kaminsky slander, which I started, I'm already almost regretting. Poor guy. Yeah.
All right. So I'm looking at teams that could use a center this offseason, might not be interested in paying up for one. Sacramento's the first one that comes to mind. Brook Lopez for Buddy Hield, and then if Sacramento needs to throw in extra sweeteners, so be it.
Wait, what? Why would they give up Buddy?
Why would Sacramento give up Buddy?
Yeah.
Because they have De'Aaron Fox and Tyrese Halliburton, and they need a center. And they seemingly don't like Buddy Hield.
And they should trade Buddy Hield for a center who is, what, 33 years old?
Isn't Buddy Hield 33 years old? Do we know his actual age?
Oh, oh.
Brook Lopez is only 31. No? Wait. No, he's 33, yeah.
Yeah, because he shares my birthday and he's 2 years younger, so okay, that should be 33. Yeah, okay. I just don't comprehend how you made the values align here. I still don't understand why the Kings would try to pair De'Aaron Fox, who's like 23, 24, with someone who's 10 year his senior and doesn't really play a fast-paced game, which we have been clamoring for in Sacramento ever since the coaching change.
Yes.
Since, what? Why? I don't
Kings.
Understand your logic here.
They're the Kings.
Because they're the Kings?
No, okay. I mean, honestly, like, if they don't want to pay up for Rashawn, they're not right. going to have a ton of good options at center. Like, okay, you could bring back Hassan Whiteside, cool.
You know, right.
Like, maybe you overpay Nerlens Noel. But, like, maybe you see we can have a floor spacer for De'Aaron Fox. We can have a guy who anchored one of the best defenses in the NBA over the last 3 years. And we can bring in Brook Lopez, who has this championship experience now. Like, we just need guys in our locker room who aren't these mercenaries. We need someone to help us set this winning culture. Maybe Brook Lopez could be that guy.
Right, because that's what the Kings should worry about right now. Championship experience.
Yeah. It's got to start somewhere. Ask the Suns.
Okay. I mean, I know you and I make fun of the Kings a lot. This is squeezing the lemon a bit too far.
Okay. Gerald, am I totally off base with this one?
I think I think the only way something like that happens is if the Luke Walton Buddy Hield relationship gets so bad that it's like irreparable, and they have to force a trade where he gets out. Because I think like Buddy just has more value at this point as a shooter for what he does than Brook Lopez does in a vacuum. So I feel like the Bucks would be pretty stoked about a trade like that. But for the Kings, I mean, even with those issues right there on the wing and in the backcourt, I don't think Brook Lopez provides enough value where you're getting a good return unless you just have to, like, make a panic trade of some sort.
Okay, okay.
Remember, Gerald is a guest here. That was his very polite way of saying, what the hell are you talking about, you weirdo?
That's fair. All right, well, okay. let's move on. I have two other potential, three other, actually. Brook Lopez reunion with the Lakers, and we could send back either Kuzma or KCP.
Why would you want to do that to the Bucks? Why, they just won the championship. They have great chemistry. Why, Brian? Why do you hate the Bucks?
I don't hate that. I'm just throwing out potential ideas. We could we could move on. I mean, Kuzma, I think, would be interesting for them.
He would get murdered in practice by day one, first and foremost.
By Bobby Portis.
By Giannis, like everyone.
That's true, yeah. If he shows up to the Milwaukee with that hairstyle, he's Bobby's gonna punch him in the face.
And just the bravado as well. Yeah. Like, are we absolutely sure in a game six, game seven setting that he's not gonna be, "Bud, give me the ball. Like, move away, Giannis, Chris, and Drew. I got this. Kyle got it. Kuz got it." Like, no, I don't want Kyle Kuzma anyway near the Bucks if I'm the Bucks. Like, I will say, though, you're aligning on value for a change.
Okay. That's good. We're getting somewhere. Okay. Let's go to their crosstown neighbors, the Los Angeles Clippers. This one's tricky because you could do just like Luke Kennard for Brook Lopez straight up, but I don't think the Bucks say yes to that. But if Serge Ibaka opts in, and we do Kennard and Ibaka for Lopez and Dante DiVincenzo, because maybe the Bucks don't want to pay Dante.
I think you had it right the first time.
Kennard just for Lopez?
I kind of like that one.
There we go!
Yeah. Well, I mean, see, I had to be blown away, but this is a good one, because as we saw, Drew Holiday does tend to have these stretches where he offensively is horrible.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sorry, but that's just like that is what it is.
To put it lightly.
He needs someone who can take over possessions here and there from the perimeter, who isn't solely Giannis or Chris Middleton. Luke Kennard is a pick and roll guy. He's also a great spot up guy. He is probably the one player in the league who'd come into that team somewhat effortlessly and bring some offense, some on-ball creation, and really lighten the offensive load off Drew Holiday. I don't hate that one, Brian. I'm sort of surprised you said that the Bucks would be the ones to decline this, because like, he's younger as well. Like, he fits Giannis's timeline a little bit more. I would go the other way, that I mean, it might be LA who says, should we do that?
See, I'm more of the, I feel like, I mean, obviously Brook Lopez is older, so I'm having to take that into account as I go with this, but I think the step that you take back defensively hurts for the Bucks. Like, Luke Kennard was pretty targeted consistently throughout the Clippers playoff run, and obviously he wasn't playing, you know, starters minutes or whatever, but and I think the Bucks would be well suited to hide that a little bit better when you've got a trio like Giannis and Holiday and Chris Middleton. But I would be curious how they fill that center gap with Brook Lopez on the way out, because obviously Giannis can play the five and stretches in the playoffs, but like during the regular season grind of 82 games or whatever it is, who are you getting that can fill those shoes defensively a little bit? I mean, they could very well do that just fine and be fine, and Luke Kennard's creation would be great. But I think for me, it would be contingent on how they fill that five spot with Brook Lopez on the way out, if they're not doing the Ibaka and Dante DiVincenzo thing.
Yeah, that's where I looped in those other two guys, because I figured Ibaka could fill in some of those minutes as well.
But can't you just find someone off the scrap heap, honestly? I mean, I'm not saying that he would be the right choice. I'm just, it's just me picking a name out of a hat, really. But like, for example, a Hassan Whiteside, like if you get him to play like 20 minutes per game on a min deal, mm-hmm. like wouldn't that
I mean, there's,
be okay?
There are a lot of guys out there, like a Cody Zeller is going to be out there. Maybe you just swap one Lopez brother for the other, bring in Robin Lopez. Tice, if you want him on the MLE.
I would like Robin Lopez in that spot if you're gonna make that trade. I don't know as much about like a Whiteside, maybe a Cody Zeller, but I feel like another Lopez brother would be defensively a pretty good stand-in for the other Lopez.
Yeah. Right, and he knows the system. Mm-hmm. I mean, he played there, and he's also a surprisingly adept post scorer, much like Brook, which I was the one saying I would hate to lose that, but you're getting a significant portion of the defense in return. You're still getting the post-up thing. Probably not getting the three-point shooting, but you know right. what? If you get Luke Kennard instead, you can work things around. Question is if Robin is too busy watching Paddington.
Phenomenal franchise. Who could blame him?
that was epic sibling trolling.
Yeah.
Like I don't think I've ever seen a better sibling trolling job. That was tremendous. A+, Robin.
Yeah. Gorgui Jiang's another guy. Dwayne Dedman also available. So like there are
Dedman. Yeah.
There are some cheap options that's what I'm saying. Like if they're not gonna utilize Brook Lopez as much offensively because they are feeding so many touches to Giannis, Chris, and Drew. Can you get away with signing one of these guys on a mid deal or a Daniel Tice for the MLE and trade Lopez for someone who can help you in these smaller ball looks? And that's kind of where my thought process was to even broach the Brook Lopez trades. The last one I came up with, and this is one where I think Milwaukee's going to have to send more, but Charlotte also needs a starting center. So Brook Lopez plus question mark, whether it's picks or Dante, to the Charlotte Hornets for Terry Rozier.
I think you should have quit while you were ahead.
I should have saved the Clippers one for last. Damn it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it will give them another scoring option on the perimeter, which I wouldn't hate. And Terry Rozier is legitimately underrated, but he's also going to be a free agent after next season, and he is going to look for a major payday. And I just wonder if you wouldn't rather than go with Kennard, who's on a longer deal.
Well, Kennard's got
3 years left.
Four
after this one.
Four. It's a
four. Oh yeah, it's only it hasn't kicked in yet.
Yeah, it's just starting, right. And it's the fourth year is a team option. But yeah, it's at 12.7, 13.7, and then 14.7 for the final 2 years.
Yeah, no, that would be my pick if I had. So how many trades were that? Four?
Yeah.
And you hit on one, so you're shooting 25%? That's okay.
I'm channeling my inner Ben Simmons at the free throw line.
Yeah, yeah, you are. That's very on-brand Sixers for you. Good on you, Brian.
Good. All right. Well, I just wanted to throw them out there as some possibilities to explore this offseason. Not saying they're going to even look at them, but if I were running the Bucks, I would at least be like, silently calling around and seeing what I could get for Brook. All right, well, that is a good place for us to wrap up. So, Gerald, thank you again for joining us today. One last time, can you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys. You can follow me on Twitter at Gerald Bourguet, GERALDBOURGUET, and you can read my work at fansided.com/MBA. And listen to the Valley of the Suns podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Awesome. Yeah, please follow Gerald. Lots of Suns news coming this offseason. So definitely will be worth a follow and keeping up with his work at FanSided as well. Also, thank you all, as always, for listening in today. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews, and we are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Stporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen and our special guest, Gerald Bourguet. Have a good one, guys. Enjoy the off-season, which really is going to hit, like, immediately. We got the draft next week, free agency right after that, so no rest for us for a few more weeks, but good Godspeed, good luck to both of you. For
silly season is here, and I can't wait.
Yes. All right, later, guys.
Later.